Okay. Everyone get enough sleep? These are four classes on Chapter 9 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life on Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom. And this a proper, thorough teaching on this chapter would take months. You know, really, 20, 30, 40 sessions. So we're doing them in four. And so my advice to all of us, including myself, is to relax. I remember when I taught this sections from this chapter as part of the ACI curriculum. I think it's course 12. Many years ago now, the first time I taught it, just hours and hours and hours trying to prepare and understand before I taught it. And that must have been 15 years ago, maybe, 13 years ago. So 13 years have progressed, have gone by, and, you know, I've maintained my studies. And I found myself when I was preparing for this version of the course, which includes all the verses. Course 12 doesn't include all the verses, which is easier. But I still found, like, you know, just hours and hours of preparation and consulting the commentaries. There are several commentaries in English. The Dalai Lama has taught this chapter many times, and two of those teachings have been published in books. One, a complete verse-by-verse, more or less, commentary, and another one a little more fragmentary. And then there are plenty of other commentaries around. And it makes it a little easier to have a commentary, but it's still hard. It's just difficult, okay? And there's several reasons why, I think. First of all, it's difficult to understand emptiness. Emptiness is really the subject of this chapter, shunyata. And the reason why it's difficult isn't, I think, so much intellectually. It's difficult because our ignorance is so hardwired. It is just so hardwired that there's blockages, you know, in our minds when we hear the truth. And you know, I remember going to Dalai Lama teachings on you know, deep topics like emptiness, and just falling asleep, you know. Like the demon would come and just, like, you know. And then I, like, tried all kinds of strategies. So I would, like, I'll just sleep during the Tibetan bits. And then when the English guy comes on, I'll kind of wake up again. And, you know, that sort of didn't work really. And, you know, it's just funny like that, you know. The mind just kind of resists very strongly. So that's one reason why it's difficult. Another reason why I find this chapter more difficult than Nagarjuna, actually. Because, you know, Nagarjuna is pretty straightforward. Shantideva is interacting with other schools all the time. He's interacting with other positions all the time. And so you have to at least sort of know what those other positions are to understand, like, what he's against. So it's not just kind of like trying to understand, you know, Madhyamaka, you know, philosophy, but also Sankhya. He's addressing Sankhya philosophy, mind only. There's a big section in this class on the mind-only school, Chittamatra. And the mind-only school is a very complex philosophical doctrine. You know, Jeffrey Hopkins, who some of you may have heard of, a great, great scholar of Tibetan Buddhism, wrote three huge volumes in English trying to, you know, like, on the mind-only school. Very complex school. So that's another reason why it's difficult. A third reason why it's difficult is that, and this also pertains to Nagarjuna, is that Shantideva is using language, using concepts, using words, using theories, and so forth, But he says right at the beginning that the intellect will always be wrong. The intellect is always deceptive. For reasons that I've talked about earlier in the early classes, we distort things through words. We don't capture things in words. We distort them. So there's just no alternative, of course, to using words to convey information, to convey language, to convey thoughts. And so Shanti Devi uses words, but always with the kind of intention, I think. Nagarjuna certainly has this intention of using words to overthrow words, to using words to undercut our reliance on concepts. So it's kind of like guerrilla warfare, it's just like taking pot shots all the time at the intellect. So, that's just a little preamble. And if we're going to do this chapter in four classes, I can't, you guys have to stop distracting me with all of these, tangents. So we better get to it. But the first thing I said is the most important, I think. Just relax, okay? Just relax. And get what you can out of it. And I'll do my best to make it understandable. There are some verses in this chapter I can't say I understand properly. And I'll tell you when they come. And I'll give you my best shot at it and all like that. Some of them I think I understand pretty well. But some of them I don't. And it's okay. It's not the point really to master the ninth chapter. Intellectually. The point is to use the intellect to get to the point where you can jump off from the intellect, leave the intellect behind and get a non-conceptual understanding of what he's trying to talk about with concepts. That is called in the Buddhist tradition, Mahayana Buddhist tradition, the direct perception of emptiness. The direct yogic perception, sometimes they call it yogic direct perception of emptiness. And that is not a matter of concepts. That's not a matter of analysis or logic. Logic and analysis, understanding intellectually, the philosophy of emptiness and dependence origination, interdependence, that can bring you to the jumping off point. It can bring you to the cliff. But the direct perception of the unmediated by words perception, unmediated by concepts, direct perception, that's jumping off the cliff. That's free floating, in midair with no support, no ground, okay? Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche once said, the bad news is that you've been pushed out of an airplane with no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. So that's the leaving behind the reliance that we all have on the intellect. I think I really remember talking a great deal about that in the Nagarjuna course that we did at Oasis last time I was in Singapore. We grasp on to the intellect very strongly, maybe almost as much as the body. Grasping onto the physical body, we grasp onto our minds. We grasp onto the idea that we can figure things out. That we can figure, we can figure out a lot of things, right? You can figure out how to make money. You can figure out how to have certain skills. You can figure out investment banking. But you can't really figure out ultimately. You can't really figure out ultimate reality, how reality really is, with the intellect, because the intellect distorts. It distorts. Okay, so. Relax. Work hard and relax, okay? Work hard means try to get it. I'll try to get it too, and we all try to get it. But don't get frustrated. That's just not, there's no point to that, I don't understand. Well, that's okay. Just let it ride and like wash over you, a little bit like washing, like waves washing over you. And then maybe... maybe that's the best way to go about it, to come to it without that kind of anal, need to really get everything, really understand everything, All right, ready? All right. First verse, very famous verse. The sage has taught this whole set of teachings. Parikara. Parikara actually means multitude or abundance. So you could say the whole shebang in sort of colloquial English. Everything he's taught, everything else, in order to prepare us for prajna, in order to prepare us for wisdom, prajna artha, for the purpose of wisdom. And there are two schools of interpretation of this statement, depending on how you read this whole set of teachings. Some commentaries say that he's referring to chapter 8. That chapter 8, the perfection of meditation, was taught for chapter 9. And I just relay that because that is one understanding of what he means here. And it's an interesting thing to think about. You know, all of that stuff on equalizing and exchanging self for others is preparatory for wisdom, for understanding emptiness. And, you have to put that in your pipe and smoke it a little bit, like why that would be, a position that you could take on this. Many other interpreters say the whole of the guide from chapter 1 through chapter 8 has been preparation for chapter 9. All the other five perfections, the perfection of giving, the perfection of ethics, the perfection of patience or tolerance, the perfection of virya, joyful effort, the perfection of meditation, all in the interest of getting you to wisdom. So another way of thinking about that is that all of our practice, ethical practice, the practice of service to the community, service to other beings, the practice of meditation is all in the interest of wisdom. It's all to get us to wisdom. Wisdom is the golden, what is it? The golden fleece, right? It is the holy grail. It is the big prize, okay? And everything else is for that. Because awakening, nirvana and awakening, only come from wisdom. Only come from wisdom, okay? They do not come from karma. They do not come from merit. They only come from wisdom. So even the direct perception of emptiness, even the glimpse, non-conceptual glimpse of ultimate reality is not caused. It is an uncaused thing. Nirvana is not caused. It is an uncaused thing. And you could argue that awakening, too, it's a little funkier there. But awakening, full Buddhahood is also uncaused. Certainly the Dharmakaya part, getting the truth body, the mind of a Buddha is regarded as uncaused. So that means that there's nothing you can do to get it, you see? All you can do is prepare for it. And basically what we're preparing is preparing to stop something, not to acquire something, to stop, to get a nirodha in Sanskrit. Nirodha means a cessation. So nirvana is a cessation of what? Of mental afflictions and their causes, they say. It is to say something stops, not something starts. Nirvana doesn't start, right? Something non-nirvana stops. Okay? Nirvana doesn't start. Non-nirvana stops. So all of the practice, including the intellectual practice, analytical practice, the philosophical practice, is meant to get us to stop something, to stop relying on concepts, to stop relying on our practice, to stop relying on our karma or merit, and to be free. To take the jump, to take the leap. Well, Kierkegaard called it the leap of faith. Take a leap of faith. So that's two different ways of understanding. And I prefer the second of those two ways. The one he's talking about everything, is a preparation for wisdom. I don't think he's only referring to the chapter on meditation. He's talking about the whole business. So with a strong desire to end suffering, one should cultivate wisdom. So this is the motivation, you see. This is, you know, it's what, this is what's supposed to motivate us into really like trying to get it, is, you know, we want to stop suffering. And Shantideva will make a very powerful case in this chapter that the only way to stop suffering is to understand ultimate reality. The only way. Truth about reality is considered to be of two kinds. So truth, I think I mentioned this a couple of sessions ago. Truth about reality is a little bit of a fudge because it's, you know, it covers both connotations of the word satya, satya in Sanskrit. Satya can mean truth and satya can mean reality. And, you know, and truth actually means the correct, you know, matching of your understanding with what is, right? So sometimes people say there's two truths, or sometimes people say there are two realities. So I've kind of combined those two and said there are two truths about reality. Truth about reality is considered to be of two kinds, deceptive and ultimate. Deceptive, samvritti. Samvritti means covered. It's hidden somehow. And ultimate, parama artha, the highest purpose, literally, highest goal. How things really are is inaccessible to the buddhi, to the intellect. So how things really are, you can't think. Inconceivable. How things really are is inconceivable. So he says it right off the bat here. And then he's going to like talk like, for, I don't know, how many, hundred and some verses, you know, through the intellect, with the intellect, using concepts, using words. But he says right off the bat, it's kind of a disclaimer from the very start, is that the buddhi can't really understand ultimate reality. The intellect can't really get it. So we use the intellect. We have to use the intellect. We rely on the intellect. We use the intellect, but for the purpose of getting beyond the intellect. You can't, I said before that you can't karmicize your way into nirvana or awakening. You can't like work your way into it. You can't achieve it by work, by action. You also can't think your way into it either, using the intellect. Okay? And a lot of us overeducated people, and pretty much everyone in this room, I think, counts as just overeducated. You know too much, way too much. And because we had like this blessing of great education, we are more liable to rely on our intellect than other people, actually. More liable than, you know, somebody who hasn't had that benefit and, you know, relies on other aspects of their being. You know, feelings or, you know, senses or, you know, like the heart, emotion. But we rely on our minds, almost everyone. I used to joke with Cindy saying that, because Cindy used to claim, I'm a bhakti, I'm a bhakta, I'm a devotee. I practice bhakti yoga. And I said, no, you're too smart. Can't really practice bhakti yoga with the too much education like that. You have to like relinquish the intellect to practice devotion, really. You know, So anyway, he says right from the start, you know, the buddhi, the intellect screws things up and can't really access ultimate reality. So just a few words on I've divided the verses here into certain categories to kind of help us keep track of what's going on. So this category is called the two truths about reality. So I don't think he's talking about two different kinds of reality. He's talking about two kinds of understandings of the same reality. And he calls one of them deceptive. And it's not that deceptive reality is deceptive. It is that we are deceived by it. You follow the English okay? It's not that the reality itself is deceptive. It's not a fake reality. So there are two kinds of reality. Ultimate reality, deceptive reality. Deceptive reality is not any less true than ultimate reality. It's not any less of a reality than ultimate reality. So why does he call it deceptive? Because we are deceived by it. See, an unenlightened mind is deceived by it. So what is deceptive reality? Deceptive reality is the world of appearance. everything that appears, okay, everything that has that appears in our lives is deceptive reality. All the things in the world, all the people in the world, all the stuff that's going on in our minds, all of that is deceptive reality. And so how are we deceived by it? It's not that the reality is deceptive, it's that we think it's something other than it is. Okay, just a very, very easy example of that, okay? The coffee, the teacup is a changing thing. It exists as an impermanent thing, right? And that's how it exists. It exists as does everything, actually, pretty much, except for empty space. Okay, never mind about empty space. Everything else except for empty space, pretty much, exists as changing things. And they're constantly changing, right? It's not changing once in a while. Every, 10 minutes or 3 months or something like that. Moment by moment, nanosecond by nanosecond, things are changing. The teacup is changing. The hand that's holding the teacup is changing. The audience that's looking at the hand that's holding the teacup is changing. Everything is changing, constantly changing. Does it seem like that? It doesn't. We are deceived. We are deceived by the appearance of things. The appearance of things is not how the way that we see the appearance of things is not how the thing really is. In fact, you could say it like this. I mean, there's no thing here that changes. It's not that there's a teacup that changes, because if you say a teacup, already you've frozen it, right? You're saying there's an unchanging thing called a teacup that then undergoes change. She said, our language just screws us up. Our language betrays us. Necessarily, we couldn't talk otherwise, you know? There are really no nouns. There are really no nouns. And, at an even deeper level, there are no verbs either. But let's just start with the nouns part. That's easier. No, there's no objects. There's just flux. There's just constant change. So we're deceived. It's not that there isn't a reality. It's not that there isn't a reality of appearances, but we mistake that reality for a reality that it isn't. We mistake a constant, for example, constantly changing reality for a reality that's filled with things that have more or less permanence, have more or less duration to it, constantly. So the deceptive reality term, samvritti satya, has to be really understood. He's not saying that the world of appearances have no reality at all. He's not saying that. They have satya. They have some truth to them. They have some reality to them. But it's not the reality that we see in them. Okay? Because of this, the world is seen to be divided into two camps. All sentient beings can be divided into two camps. The deep practitioners, yogi, those who yoga means all kinds of things in the Indian texts. Here he's talking about yogis who really kind of get it, and the worldly, prakritaka. Prakriti means natural, nature. So the ones who are kind of like just by nature, come into the world and see the world around them. So he's also implying that those who see properly, the yogis, the deep practitioners, have to transcend their nature, in a way, their inborn nature. Ignorance comes in all kinds of forms. One of the deepest form of ignorance is inborn ignorance. Inborn. Can't help it, in a way. You're just born with it. And then there's learned ignorance also. Was like reinforced over the course of a whole lifetime by your culture, by your parents, by your own perceptions, and so forth. But innate, inborn ignorance is what we all have that. So the people who haven't transcended their inborn ignorance are one type of person. And then there's the yogis. And then he says in the next verse, even among the deep practitioners, even among yogis, lower perspectives are invalidated by higher ones because of differences in wisdom. in cases where, regardless of the purpose, both parties agree on the examples. Well, never mind that part. That's, you know, whatever. What is the differences of wisdom that he's talking about among the yogis? Okay, now he's in the camp of the people who get it. And then there's people who sort of get it and then really get it. The people who sort of get it are the ones who have cultivated analytical wisdom. Analytical wisdom means the wisdom of the brain, of the mind. And that's a very important thing to do. And the higher ones than that are the ones who have had direct experience and the wisdom that comes from that, which is not cultivated, which is not intellectual. See, it's mystical, you could say, who have had direct mystical experience of reality and who have been changed by it in the positive way. So, you know, kind of back to what I was saying last night, I think, you know, lots of people have lots of different kinds of mystical, lots of people have mystical experiences. And then lots of people, then people interpret those mystical experiences in different ways. The mystical, you know, arguably, the scholarship on this is somewhat divided. There's two ways of understanding mystical experience. One is that you have the mystical experience that you're prepared to have. Okay? So if you're brought up a Christian, you have a mystical experience of like seeing Jesus. If you're brought up a Buddhist, you have a mystical experience of no self or emptiness. If you're brought up a, you know, Muslim, you have a mystical experience of, you know, communing with Allah. You know, depends on what you've been prepared for. The other way of understanding it is everyone has exactly the same mystical experience. And then after the mystical experience, they explain it and understand it differently. Again, according to their conditioning and their background and all of that. So those are the two types of... that's one way of understanding the divisions here that he's talking about, even among the yogis, even among those people who are starting to develop understanding about how things really are. Analytical wisdom means understanding the differences properly, the distinctions between things. For example, intellectually understanding that there is a distinction between how the cup looks and how it really is. It looks like something that has some kind of duration, some kind of permanence. But intellectually, you can understand, you know, if you study and think about it, meditate on it, stuff like that, intellectually, it couldn't be that way. Intellectually, you could say, no, although it appears like that to my senses, you know, I know in my mind that it really can't be that way. So that's sort of analytical wisdom. And then direct wisdom is, you know, is not having to use the concepts and just getting it full on. That what appears is not what it seems to be without mediating that through thought, through intellectual thought. Worldly people see and conceptualize things as if they were real and not illusory. As if they were real, as if they were tattvata. They had some suchness to them, and not maya. So the word is maya for illusory. And that's the point of disputation between the deep practitioners and the worldly. Two different ways that things, of understanding the relationship between how things appear and how they are. Worldly people, that means people without, you know, development of wisdom of either kind, analytical wisdom or direct wisdom, non-conceptual wisdom, see things and think that the way they appear is the way they are. They see things like this and they say, well, that's permanent. It has some permanence to it. It looks like it has permanence to it, feels like it has permanence to it, and so it must have permanence to it. And that's the difference between the worldly person or the non-wise person and the person with wisdom, who even though they may see and feel and smell and all the rest with the senses, the same teacup, know that they're deceived by it. Know that they are being deceived by it. So again, you know, Shantideva will use the same image that I've been using now for a while. things only have a dreamlike existence. A dreamlike existence. They appear to be real, but they're not real. They appear to have a kind of reality that they don't have. That's even better to say. They appear to have a kind of reality, just like dreams do, right? When you're in the middle of a dream and you don't know that you're dreaming, that everything appears to have some kind of like reality, right? And then you wake up and you say, oh, it was only a dream. So that's a unwise way of seeing the world around us, is being taken in by the dream and thinking that the dream is real. And then the other way is also to be in the dream. Okay? There's no world of appearance possible without it having a dreamlike existence. So even for those who are wise, even those who have wisened up, the world still appears the way it does to you and me. But they're not taken in by the dream, like a lucid dreamer. You know, somebody who knows they're dreaming while they're dreaming. They know that although it appears this way, it can't be this way. Okay? Things like physical form, even though perceived directly with the senses. So, you know, the teacup can be perceived directly with the visual sense, right? And right now I'm feeling it also, so it's being perceived by the, what do you call it? Feeling, touch, yeah, sense of touch. So things like physical form, even though perceived directly with the senses, are confirmed through consensus. So it means that everyone agrees that there's a teacup here. Okay, that's how we think we know there's a teacup here, because everyone agrees there's a teacup. You know, if one person says no, that's the Empire State Building, we like, you know, start running them out of the teaching hall here. You know, get out of here, go to the mental asylum, because it's not, because we all agree it's a teacup, right? But he says that's not sufficient to prove its real existence. Just because everyone agrees on it isn't sufficient to prove that it really exists in the way that it appears to exist. Even though perceived directly with the senses are confirmed through consensus and not by means of valid perception and not by means of pramana, what's called pramana in Sanskrit. It's like the consensus that says that things are pure when they are impure, which is false. And that's just a reference to the four signs. This is, if you wanted to define Buddhism, you know, Buddhism is very hard to define. You know, you could say, well, maybe Buddhism is defined in terms of the four noble truths or something like that. Or you could say that it's defined in terms of the four lakshanas. The four lakshanas. Things are impermanent. Things have no self. You will suffer, dukkha, if you don't understand that things are impermanent and have no self, and freedom and liberation is
nirvana.
Nirvana is freedom, is peace. Nirvana is peace, is that how that's expressed. So here he's saying, like, you know, we mistake things that are impure for pure. We mistake things that are not have no permanence for things that have permanence. We mistake things that do not have a self, an Atman, an essence, for things that do. We mistake things that do not have an essence. We think that things have an essence when they don't. And we think that things that will bring us suffering will bring us happiness. The Lord taught, Lord means Buddha, taught that things exist, bhava, that there are bhavas in the world, things exist, for the purpose of dropping down to the level of the worldly. So, you know, Buddha, just like everyone, every other teacher, every other spiritual teacher, used words, you know, used concepts. And when you're using concepts, you're implying that there's something that exists behind the words. It's not just words, right? So one way of understanding what he's referring to here is in terms of the first turning of the wheel, what they call the first turning of the wheel, where the Buddha taught things like the Four Noble Truths. Life is suffering. There's a cause to suffering. There's an alternative to suffering, and there's a method for getting to the alternative to suffering. And it sounds like that those things exist, like there's really suffering. And there's really a cause for suffering. And there's really an alternative. There's really nirvana or enlightenment. And that there's really a method. There's, you know, that these things have some existence. And here he's saying, you know, Buddha just was trying to help us. He was dropping down to our level in order to help us. But there is no suffering. There is no cause of suffering. There is no alternative to suffering. There's no nirvana that exists in some kind of independent, self-existent way, and there's no method. These things are all empty. Okay, but he has to drop down in order to communicate. We have to learn through words and through the idea that, you know, things do have some kind of existence. If from the point of view. So now, here's the first example of where I use quotation marks. And like I said the other day, it's very difficult to know sometimes when Shantideva is talking with his own voice or using his voice to present an alternative, an opponent's position. So here it seems like he's presenting the opponent's position. Anytime you see the quotation marks, that was what I decided to do to indicate that it seemed to me, at least, that Shantideva was, you know, talking about an opponent's point of view. So from the opponent's point of view, if from the point of view of how things really are, things don't even have momentary existence, then this seems to contradict what's been said about deceptive reality. Okay? If in deceptive reality, the world of appearances, if things don't even have momentary stability, if change is absolute, no pauses in change, then in what sense is there deceptive reality at all? Why are you saying that there's two realities or two truths about reality? That's the opponent's point of view. There has to be something in deceptive reality for you to say there's deceptive reality. There has to be things, objects, and so that, well, maybe they're changing, but, you know, but they must have at least momentary existence. Momentary. You know, moment by moment changing, but at least they have momentary existence. Okay? Everyone follow? By the way, in this, you got to go like this, or else I'll just have to, you know, say it over again. So you say no. Okay. So we say that this is a teacup. This is an example of something that exists in deceptive reality, the world of appearances. We say it's a teacup. And then we say, yeah, but it's a changing thing. It's a changing thing. It's constantly changing. But if you don't say it's at least a thing that's changing, if it doesn't have moment-to-moment existence, teacup A, teacup B, teacup C, teacup D, changing like that. If it doesn't even have momentary existence, then there's nothing in deceptive reality. There's no content to deceptive reality. So why are you talking about two truths? Why are you talking about two versions of reality? Shantideva answers. There's no problem when it comes to deceptive reality among the deep practitioners. The yogis, they don't have any problem like this. They, unlike the worldly, perceive things as they really are. So they perceive things without even momentary existence. Okay, so how do you conceptualize that? They perceive things that don't even have, there's no teacup at all that goes through change. It's just change, you see. And so then fall back, okay? So, you know, relax, okay? And just say, like a dream. Like a dream. Things in dreams don't have even momentary existence, right? They're phantoms. Yeah? Just illusions. They function. They work. But they're just illusory. Right? So the dream metaphor is very, very useful, I think. Very, very useful. It's not that dreams don't exist, right? When you're in a dream, they certainly exist, right? The dream certainly exists. And you suffer in it, or you're happy in it, or, you know, all kinds of emotions occur, and so forth. Dalai Lama likes to say, this is the proof that deceptive reality exists, is that we suffer. You see? we're unhappy. We're not in nirvana. So must be a reason for that, right? It's that we're deceived by reality. And so deceptive reality exists as a reality that deceives, you see. So it's not like it doesn't exist at all. It's not like, you know, oh, if things don't even have momentary existence, then they have no existence at all. Okay? Just like in a dream, things in a dream have no existence, no momentary existence at all. They're not things, really, right? But they function. They work, right? They bring us happiness or unhappiness, fear or, you know, pleasure or whatever it is, right? I'll skip the next line and just go ahead because Cindy will get upset. Were it otherwise... No. How could a conqueror, that's a Buddha, who is... So this is, again, in quotation marks. So if you're saying that nothing in deceptive reality has any real existence, then I guess that means that Buddhas have no real existence either. It's a good argument, right? Actually, there's two counters here. How could a conqueror who is like an illusion, maya upama, who has the resembling of an illusion, produce merit? How could a Buddha, you know, help us in any way? If everything's just illusory, as opposed to one who truly exists. Wouldn't you have to have a truly existing Buddha to get any truly existing help from a Buddha? It's a good argument, right? And then the second one, if a living being is like an illusion, what is it that's reborn after death? A very old, you know, kind of argument against emptiness, actually. So if living beings are just, you know, kind of ghost-like, dream-like beings, then what is it that goes through birth after birth after birth? It has to be something real, wouldn't it, that goes through birth after birth? He doesn't directly answer the first question. He comes back to it in a different way. But the answer is going to be An illusory Buddha can create illusory merit. No problem. A dreamlike Buddha can create dreamlike merit. Buddhas as they appear, you know, in their appearance form in the world, are as illusory as everything else. The Nirmanakaya, some of you know, have studied the three bodies of a Buddha, maybe. The Nirmanakaya is the emanation of a Buddha in the world of form, in the world of appearance. The very word Nirmanakaya indicates that it's an illusory thing. Nirmana means can mean magic, like, you know, just an appearance that a magician, you know, creates, an illusion that a magician creates. So the appearance in the world of deceptive reality of a Buddha, that Buddha is as illusory as everything else in the world of appearances. But functions and can create merit. Second question he addresses in the next verse. Even that which is illusory goes on for as long as there is a collection of conditions. So this is to answer the objection in the verse 9 here. Well, if a living being is like an illusion, what is it that's reborn after death? Well, it doesn't matter. The illusion can go on for as long as there's causes and conditions for the illusion to maintain itself. It doesn't matter, you know, whether it's a moment or if it's over, you know, billions of lifetimes. The illusion will go on as long as the causes and conditions for keeping the illusion alive continue. Why should there be some kind of true reality to a living being just because of long duration? You know, 70-year-old person isn't any more real than a, you know, 3-month-old baby, who, you know, or let alone over lifetimes. There is no, so here's another objection. There's no negative karma accruing from things like the killing of illusory persons who do not have truly existing minds. So if everybody's just an illusion, then what does it matter if I kill them or not? Just killing an illusion. And here he makes a distinction. He makes a distinction between different kinds of illusion. But when there is the illusion of a mind, negative karma and merit arise. So there's different kinds of illusions. There's an illusion of a teacup, but a teacup has no mind. So a teacup can't create karma, negative or positive, right? Because there's no sentience to it. But sentient beings can create negative karma, good karma or bad karma, because of their minds. But their minds are as illusory as anything else. He's going to come back to it in this class, in verses like this. So sometimes we say, just as a little preview to the argument, sometimes, you know, carelessly, I think, people say, well, everything is a projection coming from my mind. Right? So the teacup is illusory because it's just a projection coming from my mind. But the mind itself is a projection. The mind itself is as illusory as what the mind projects. And in fact, the mind can't exist as a projector without a projection. There's no projector without a projection. There's no projection without a projector. There's no projector without a projection. This is interdependence, okay? How things really exist interdependently. No projection, the projector depends on the projection. The projection depends on the projector. Neither can exist without the other, and so to say, my mind is projecting reality assumes that there's a mind or projector that exists before the projection that the projector is projecting, which is false. An illusory mind is not produced by means of mantras and the like. So here's the objection again. Well, if you say the mind is illusory, well, it's not the same as, like, you know, a magician who says some magic words over something and brings things into creation. You know, brings a, what do they call it? Those magicians, the modern magicians in Las Vegas and stuff.
Illusionists.
Who bring an illusion into being, right? Who's those guys that created tigers and stuff?
Siegfried and Roy,
these pair of magicians. External hard drive. So he's saying, like, well, the mind isn't like that. There's nobody who said, you know, presto changeo or abracadabra or, you know, mantras over it and then brought it into existence. And then Shantideva answers it. But there are different types of illusions. I already kind of talked about that. There are different kinds of illusions produced by different kinds of conditions. And then he says something very important, refrigerator magnet worthy. There is absolutely no single condition that brings about everything. There's no cause, single cause, that brings about any single result. And that's why one has to be kind of careful, more than kind of, I think, about thinking that you know how karma works. That, you know, that if I do X, then Y will follow. Causality is much, much more complicated than that. Has to be. No single condition can bring about any single effect, let alone everything. So here again, objection. If one who is liberated because of ultimate reality, if one who has nirvritta is a kind of a synonym for nirvana. If one achieves nirvana through understanding ultimate reality, still cycles through deceptive reality, still appears in deceptive reality. So, you know, they say that the Buddhas are, you know, appear in the world, right? They appear in the world. So, but the Buddhas are supposed to be liberated from ultimate reality. So what are they doing in deceptive reality? Then even a Buddha would still be in samsara. So if they're not, like, escape from samsara, escape from deceptive reality, then even a liberated person, would paradoxically still be unliberated because they'd be in samsara. What would be the point of a bodhisattva's way of life? Isn't the point to escape deceptive reality? As long as the conditions that sustain it are not eliminated, illusion is not eliminated, but due to the elimination of the conditions, even deceptive reality does not arise. Now, this one I think we have to understand, like, not so literally. What he's saying is that as long as the conditions of ignorance are present, we will be deceived by deceptive reality. But when those conditions are not present, then we will no longer be deceived by deceptive reality. It's not that we won't be in deceptive reality, but we won't be deceived by deceptive reality. So someone who's not deceived by deceptive reality, for them it's not really deceptive. The world of appearances is not really, you can't really call it deceptive reality. You see? Buddhas appear in the same deceptive reality that what we call deceptive reality. An enlightened being doesn't like zip off into another reality on Alpha Centauri somewhere. Yeah, they're in the same reality, but they're not deceived by it anymore. Because the conditions, the causes and conditions that maintain the illusion have ceased. All right, so part two, mind-only school. Everyone okay still? Want to take a deep breath? breathe. Get something, chocolate or something. Chitta Matra. So this is a fairly long section. And really, we don't have time, and I don't have the expertise, actually, to go into great depth about what he's talking about with the mind-only school. Okay, so we'll do our best and just relax and get through it. And the next section will come after that. So here, the mind-only school is sometimes called idealism. It's labeled idealism. There's a Western philosophical tradition that's called idealism, which kind of means that everything is a projection from my mind. Nothing exists apart from my mind's imagining it. Okay? And that's kind of why they call it mind only. Mind only. Chitta matra. It means there's nothing really outside of the mind. The school actually says that. There's nothing bahya, outside, external. Nothing's external to the mind. So the mind sees it is from the mind that changing things come. This is a changing thing, right? It's from the mind that changing things come. And then it's also from the mind that concepts come. Cup. Okay? This is something. It's a changing thing. Let's just call it a changing thing, okay? Change, constantly changing thing. And then another part of the mind, and that's coming from the mind. And then another part of the mind says, cup. Gives it a label. And the problem, according to the mind-only school, is mistaking the label for the thing. You get confused because you think cup is what this changing thing really is. And the goal is to, like, clear the mind of concepts and see changing things as they truly are. As changing things. Constantly changing things. Okay? That's a really thumbnail sketch of a very complex philosophical school called mind-only. What we need to know here for our purposes is that they believe that there's really a mind. Okay? Really a mind. A mind that then projects reality. Okay? When even erroneous views do not exist, how will illusion be comprehended? What is it that perceives erroneous views as erroneous? So the mind-only objection here. See, if there's not really a mind, a truly existing mind of some sort, then how are we ever going to understand that we're thinking wrong? What is it that will liberate us from wrong thought if not a mind that thinks right? Good question. When, according to you, even illusion does not exist, what will be comprehended? Although it is thought to be just an aspect of the mind, it is other than that when it comes to how things really are. So this is Shantideva's reply. Even illusions do not exist. What will be comprehended means something like, according to you, concepts are illusions and do not exist. So even illusions don't exist according to the mind-only school. Only reality exists. No existing illusions. So although although it is thought to be just an aspect of the mind, it is other than that when it comes to how things really are. This is kind of leading up to. I'll try to cut to the chase a little bit. Shantideva will argue that there is no mind apart from the object that the mind is thinking about. There's no independently existing mind that then perceives or projects an object. The mind is only one half of a relationship. So, in other words, you could say there is no mind. There's just thinking, that which is thought, and the relationship, the interdependent relationship between them. There's no thinker without a thought. There's no thought without a thinker. Neither can exist without the other, and if the mind is illusory, then by what are things perceived? If you say my mind, this is a mind-only position, you know, keep track of the quotes here. If you're saying that the mind's just an illusion like everything else, in the sense that it only exists interdependently, does not exist independently, then by what are things perceived? What's perceiving things? The protector of the world has said that mind does not perceive mind. That the mind cannot perceive itself. Okay? We'll come back to that. The mind is just like the blade of a sword that does not cut itself. Sword can't cut itself. The mind can't perceive itself. Then the mind-only guy comes along and says, no, no, no. It's like a lamp that illuminates itself. I guess there are no lamps in here, but if there was a little table lamp here, when you turn on the table lamp, it illuminates the lamp that has been turned on. Okay, that's this. So similarly, the mind can illuminate itself, just like a lamp, when turned on, illuminates itself. And then the answer to that is a lamp is not illuminated since it is not shrouded in darkness. So let's reel back from that a minute. When a lamp is turned on, does the lamp illuminate itself? No. The illumination illuminates the lamp, not the lamp. The lamp doesn't illuminate itself. The light that comes from the lamp illuminates the lamp, number one. Number two, it doesn't just illuminate the lamp. It illuminates everything else around it. So that's the easy way, I think, of on. This is a very old example. There's a whole chapter in Nagarjuna on this, actually, which I haven't actually, you know, translated and worked on yet, but I will someday. A lamp is not illuminated since it's not shrouded in darkness. This kind of is referring to a very, very long story. I think we in the modern world think of darkness as the absence of light, right? As the absence of light. In the ancient world, they thought of it as a positive thing. Darkness was something, and then light was something else. And then there was, but Nagarjuna and others sort of demonstrate that if they are really two different things, one can never overcome the other. Because light would, when you turn the light on, everything's dark, when you turn the light on, light would have to come and touch darkness in order for it to push it away. And these two things can't exist at the same time. Any more than hot and cold can exist at the same time. Light and darkness can't exist at the same time. A blue thing does not need something in order to be blue, like a crystal does. So it is that things are perceived to be either dependent or on another or not. So mind-only school comes and says, the mind is like a blue thing. It doesn't depend on something else to be blue. And he says, like a crystal does. A crystal, you know, a crystal is just, you know, transparent, right? But if you put a blue cloth under the crystal, then it becomes blue. But a gemstone like lapis lazuli is blue, by nature blue. So just like that, the mind has a nature of its own. It doesn't need something else to be itself. See, it's a naturally blue thing. It's a natural mind, okay? And then the Shantideva answers, the blue thing is not to be regarded as the cause of the blueness of the blue thing, as it is in the case of something which is not blue. What blue thing would by itself make itself blue? So just blue things also rely on other things for their blueness. Okay, they're not just like pop up in the world as blue. One says the lamp illuminates when one truly knows that. When one says the intellect illuminates, by what is that known? Did I put quotation marks around that?
Yeah.
So when you say the lamp illuminates, you say, well, there's a lamp. that illuminates. When you say the intellect illuminates, who knows that? When you say the intellect has gained clarity or illuminates a problem or something like that, who knows that? This must be the mind. So there must be a mind that knows that the mind has illuminated something. Self, say all of this is about, can the mind know itself? And if the mind can know itself, then it has a kind of an independent existence. You see? If it can know itself. When the illumination or non-illumination is not perceived by anyone, talking about it is futile, like discussing the beauty of the daughter of a barren woman. So when you're saying that, he's saying here that the subject depends on the object and the object depends on the subject. When the illumination or non-illumination is not perceived by anyone, when there's not an object, the illumination is the object of a subject mind that perceives the illumination. If you're talking about that, if you're talking about outside of that relationship, it's an imaginary thing. Then he says, if there's no apprehension, how, this is the mind-only position, if there's no apprehension, how is consciousness recalled? And then the example is really funny. The recollection is due to drawing a connection when one has experienced something else, like the poison of a rat. So you need to have commentary on that. Like, what the hell? Right? What do you mean? What does this mean? So first of all, what he's saying is, look, he's talking about memory here. How does memory work? When you remember something like a rat biting you and putting poison into your body, you know, maybe that happened to you a year ago or something like that. When you are remembering that, you are remembering that the mind was aware of the rat biting you. It was not just the rat biting you, but a mind that was aware of its getting bitten. So therefore, there must be a mind that's aware of itself. In the past, the mind was aware of itself when it was aware that it was being bitten by a rat. And the answer to that is that the mind wasn't aware of it in memory. When we think back on something, we're not thinking back on the way that we were thinking back then. We're thinking about the relationship between ourselves and the object that made us think the way we were back then. Okay? Just a very detailed argument on why the mind can't be aware of itself. He's going to come to a much easier way of understanding this. In a minute, so bear with me, okay? It illuminates itself because of the perception that occurs when it is joined to different conditions. This is a very difficult verse. It's understood to mean that there are people who can read other people's minds. So if you can read other people's minds, why can't you read your own mind? And the answer to that, a jar which appears due to the application of ointment to the eyes in a magical rite is not itself the ointment. So the ability to read other people's minds is like applying some, you know, magic, some kind of magical power to the mind. And just because the magical power is there doesn't mean that that's the mind itself. This is the easier verse, okay? It's not things that are seen, heard, and known that's being refuted here. It's not that there aren't visible things in the world, audible things in the world, knowable things in the world that's being disputed. It is the conceptualization of those things as truly existing, which is the cause of our suffering, that's here repudiated. It's misunderstanding how they exist. It's not that they don't have some existence out there, but it's the conceptualization that we have of them. That's the problem. See? It's the way we think about them that's the problem. Illusion is regarded as neither different from the mind nor different from the mind. Is they're regarded neither different from the mind nor not different from the mind. Did I put that one in quotations also? Yeah. Some people would. Let's assume that it doesn't. Let's assume this is Shantideva, okay? Illusion is regarded as neither different from the mind nor not different from the mind. If it really exists, how could it not be different? If something exists, it has to be different from other things. That's what makes it exist. So if the projection exists, then it has to be different from the mind that projects it. Right? And if it's not different, then it can't really exist. Because it's not different from the mind that projects it. So it's not a different existing thing than the mind that projects it. So it's either the same as or different than. It's an old argument in Nagarjuna. It's either same as or different than. And if it can't be either one of them, then it doesn't exist. How could an existing thing do anything while based on a non-existing thing? So how could an existing thing, like the mind, do anything if it's based on illusory things like the objects in the world? The mind-only school has assumed that the apparent objects in the world do not exist as they appear. So how could a mind be an existing thing cognizing a non-existing thing? This mind of yours would be reduced to something independent and isolated, all by itself, not relying on the objects of the mind, not relying on the subject-object relationship. It would just be subject all by itself. If the subject mind was freed from objects, then everyone would be a Buddha. Why does he say that, I wonder? If the subject mind was freed from its dependence on objects, then it would be cognizing ultimate reality, like a Buddha does. Okay? The subject-object distinction would seem to have broken down. It can't really break down, but it would seem to break down because the subject mind is thinking about the emptiness of the subject mind. Yeah. So what good is there in declaring that everything is mind only? All right, let's stop. Done. You could study that section for, I don't know, like 2 months maybe, at least. Yeah. So we just do our best, huh? Just do our best. The bottom line here is that there cannot be an independently existing mind. Impossible. The mind is one half of a relationship. There's no thinker without a thought. There's no thought without a thinker. Neither can exist without the other. I don't even have to say it again. And neither can appear first. All right, so now here's another section. Even when we know that things are like an illusion, this is another opponent apparently. Even when we know that things are like illusions, how will a mental affliction be put to rest? Desire for an illusory woman arises even in the one who created her. Because the creator's habitual arising of mental afflictions towards objects of knowledge have not been eradicated. The habitual arising of mental afflictions about objects of knowledge have not been eradicated. When he sees her, the habit of thinking about the emptiness of things is weak. So he's talking about like people who've, you know, come to a, you know, to a retreat at Barabador and have learned that everything's kind of just a projection, everything's kind of an illusion and like that. And then they see like a, you know, male or, you know, whatever, object of desire. And then you still want it. Still lust after it, even though you have some sense that it's empty. Well, it's just, he says here, the old habits haven't really died. You know, you may have like some small intellectual understanding of emptiness, but that's not enough to change long-standing habits, which are mental afflictions. So when he said, due to the strengthening of the habit of thinking of the emptiness of things. So over and over again, study, over and over again, meditating, over and over trying to get it. The habit of thinking that things exist is eliminated. The old habits of thinking that things exist, especially things exist as they appear to exist, is eliminated. So it all comes down to habit, rehabituating your mind. And because one has practiced thinking nothing exists, one later abandons even this idea. So this is a very interesting verse. He's sort of recommending, as a first stage, just go around and say nothing exists. Nothing exists. Nothing exists. That teacup doesn't exist. This audience doesn't exist. The chair doesn't exist. Nothing exists. And that breaks an old standing habit of saying everything exists the way it seems to. You know, it's like fighting opposite. It's you going to the opposite extreme to fight the hard-wired tendency to cling to this extreme. Things really exist. So you said, no, they don't exist. I heard that Jeffrey Hoppins, the very same Jeffrey Hoppins I was mentioning before, he wrote in a book once that he practiced, he did this practice for a couple of days or weeks or something. He just said, all day long, he says, I don't know. I don't know. The mantra, I don't know. I don't know. And this is similar. Things don't exist. And then he says, once you get that in place, then you can start working on things don't not exist either. Things don't not exist. So you're saying things don't exist in relation to the belief that things do exist. Things don't exist. And then you say, and things don't not exist either. Why? Because non-existence depends on existence. Okay? Non-existence, to say something does not exist, depends on the idea that things exist. So you're using the opposite, things exist, you know, we all believe things exist, so you're saying things don't exist in order to fight that tendency to say things do exist. But then you have to move to the next thing and say things do not exist either, because things not existing depends on things existing. And if things exist, then you're back to square one. Okay? That's like, Nagarjuna could have said this. That's right out of Nagarjuna. Things neither exist, nor don't exist, nor neither exist, nor not exist, or both exist and don't exist. Does that cover all of it? That's it. Things do not exist, things don't. Do not exist. Things do not exist. Things don't both exist and not exist. And things don't neither exist nor not exist.
And what exists?
What's
the answer?
Well,
No ground.
You just jumped off the cliff. You see? There's nothing to hold on to anymore. Due to the stream of habit. Okay. If one asserts it does not exist and there is no existing thing to perceive, then how could a non-existing thing without any basis stand before the mind? If one asserts it does not exist and there's no existing thing there because it does not exist, then how could a non-existing thing stand before the mind? How can you think non-existing thing if there's not something that the non-existing thing refers to? So here's exactly what, you know, the point of just going through that Nagarjunian syllogism. So Shantideva like makes it explicit. When neither an existing thing nor a non-existing thing stands before the mind, then since there's no other way to go, see, there's no other place to run to. Things either exist or don't exist. But if they neither exist nor not exist, then the mind has nothing to hold on to. Since there is no other way to go, the mind being without a foundation, no support, no ground, comes to peace. That's nirvana. Nirvana is the cessation of any position, the cessation of any grasping to ground. Existence, non-existence, this or that, up or down, you see, nothing to hold the mind onto. Just as a wish-fulfilling gem or wish-granting tree fulfills one's wishes, so too does the image of the conqueror regarded, so too is the image of the conqueror regarded because of his vows and disciples. So kind of comes back to that question, well, what good are Buddhas then? If nothing, you know, has any true existence, How would a Buddha help us? And it's interesting that he uses the term image, bimba. Bimba in Sanskrit means like a mirror or a reflection in a mirror. So the Buddhas that appear in the world are just reflections. They're just as illusory as everything else. Other texts also say this. Other Buddhist texts say this, that the Nirmanakaya, the emanation bodies of a Buddha, are just like reflections from the mirror, which is the Dharmakaya. The real Buddha is non-visible. The real Buddha makes no appearance at all, but then sends out like illusory kinds of appearances in the world. And because of his vows and disciples, because of the vows and devotion of the disciples, that Buddha can help. See, the Buddha is not helping directly. Okay? There's only reflections of the Buddha in the world. So, in what sense does the Buddha help us? Well, the mind that perceives the illusory Buddha is helped by the perception of the illusory Buddha. Just as when a dealer in antidotes dies after having completed a pillar, this is referring to some ancient Indian practice that I don't really know much about. Antidotes to poison, and there must have been some kind of like magic pillar or something that you could go to that the guy had created that will help get the poison out, can still neutralize poisons and the like long after the creator of the pillar has died. So too does the pillar of the conqueror, established in accordance with the bodhisattva's way of life, complete all tasks even when the bodhisattva has passed on into nirvana. He's left behind what? Especially the Dharma. Okay? Bodhisattvas have passed on into Buddhahood, Buddhahood has passed on into nirvana, but they left behind the Dharma. And that can still help us. Right? How could worship of those who have gone beyond ordinary consciousness? Acittika. Acittika means like they don't think like us no more. How could worship of those who have gone beyond ordinary consciousness produce results? How would that help us? Because it is taught that it is the same, regardless of whether the being is present or is passed on to into nirvana. It's left behind the reflection, left behind the echo. But it's only an echo, you see? It's only an illusion, only a reflection. According to authoritative sources, there is a result in that case, no matter if it exists deceptively or truly. Just as worship of a true Buddha has a result. Doesn't matter if it's only deceptive. Doesn't matter if it's only illusory. It works in an illusory way. Karma's like that too, right? We did a whole thing on that last time we were in Singapore. Right? Karma works, but only in a dreamlike way, only in an illusory way. Similarly with the Buddha. The Buddha is present and helpful, but only in an illusory way. So don't grasp onto the Buddha either. You know, everyone wants to grasp onto something. As soon as you take something away, you grasp onto something else. Grasping onto the Buddha is grasping too. The Buddha has no more real existence than anything else. Okay? Has an illusory type existence in the world of appearances. Has an illusory type of existence, which functions very, very well to help us. All right. Last bit. It's interesting that he threw this in. There was a big debate when the Mahayana scriptures first started appearing in India among the Buddhists. As early as Heart Sutra and Diamond Cutter Sutra and stuff like that, which is earlier than Shantideva probably. Maybe right around the time of the turn of the common era, in the first couple of centuries AD, Mahayana Buddhist scriptures started to appear. And the other Buddhists said, what the hell is this? Where'd this come from? You know, who made this stuff up? We've got the scriptures from the Pali Canon and stuff like that, and that's what the Buddha said. What the hell are you guys doing? You're making up some new stuff. Has no authority. The Diamond Cutter Sutra answers that question in a very interesting way. I don't know if you remember, cast your mind four years ago. But, Diamond Cutter Sutra basically says the historical Buddha isn't the Buddha. That's not the real Buddha. The real Buddha is always present. Never has been born, never dies. It's always present, always available. See, inspiration is always available from the real Buddha. That historical Buddha is, well, you know, whatever. But we got, you know, the real Buddha is, you know, constantly downloading stuff. Right? So Shantideva, you know, is addressing the same question of the authority of Mahayana scriptures. In a way, you could say the authority of his own scripture. So, this is the easy bit. We're done with the hard stuff for this class, okay? Was it really bad? Was it really hard? Yeah. Liberation comes from seeing the four worthy truths, the four Arya truths. This is in quotations, right? This is the Hinayana opponent. Liberation comes from seeing the four worthy truths. So what's the point of seeing emptiness? Why do I need to like spend so much time here with emptiness? I already got the four noble truths. I just like realized that life is suffering, that there's a cause to suffering, there's an alternative to suffering, and follow the Eightfold Path. That's all I need. What the hell's this new emptiness stuff coming along? Why do I need that? So Shantideva says, well, according to authority, according to scripture, there is no enlightenment without this path. There's no enlightenment without true realization of emptiness, deep realization of emptiness. So he's kind of calling upon his own scripture. According to scripture, according to authority, you know, well, whose authority? This is a Mahayana position, okay? So he's answering the Hinayana by saying, well, our scriptures say that the only way to really achieve liberation is through seeing emptiness. The Mahayana is certainly not substantiated. Well, those scriptures are bogus. That's the Hinayana says, those scriptures are bogus. So, big deal, so they say something. They're not substantiated. There's no validity to them. So then Shantideva comes back into the Hinayana and says, well, how is your scripture substantiated? You know, what makes your scripture valid and our scripture not valid? And the Hinayana guy says, well, because we both agree that they're valid. Because the Mahayana position says that the Hinayana scriptures are valid. Mahayana, when Mahayana came up, they didn't say all that Pali scripture, all those Hinayana scriptures were no good. They absorbed them. They said, yeah, you know, that's right. Here, but just like in Christianity, actually. You know, Christianity came up with the New Testament, but they didn't throw out the Old Testament. They just absorbed it. So the Hinayana guy says, you know, well, our scriptures are true because we both agree that they're true, you know. But you didn't so substantiate it from the very start. So Mahayana guy comes back and said, the Pali scriptures weren't scriptures from the very time that they were written. They first had to go through a whole series of councils. I mean, you know, this is historically they did. The councils came together and a whole bunch of monks, you know, convened and kind of made decisions as to which one was going to get in and which one. All traditions do this. At some point, that you know, there's a authority that comes in and they say these ones are in and these ones are out. So they weren't authoritative from the very start. That's one way of understanding it. Here's another way. I think this is more what Shantideva was getting at, actually. That scriptures aren't true in and of themselves. They're only validated by experience. You know, scripture says something, you try it, you say that works, so that scripture is true. But the scripture isn't true until it's validated by experience. I like that understanding of scripture very well. Yeah, because then the criterion is utility. Does it function? Does it work? And if it works, great, then it's scripture. And if it doesn't work, well, that's the hell. Yeah, get rid of it. When it comes to Mahayana, you should give the same consideration. So when it comes to these Mahayana scriptures, these relatively new Mahayana scriptures, well, you know, give it a go. See if they work or not. See if they function to bring happiness, to bring more happiness and so forth. That will be the only true test. If something is regarded as true when it's believed by both of the other parties, like, you know, they agreed, the Hinayana and Mahayana both agree that the Hinayana scriptures are true, but if that's the only criterion, if consensus is true, well, then non-Buddhist scriptures are true too, because a lot of other people think they are, the Veda in this case. Then even the Vedas and other texts are true. Because there's a whole big consensus there that, you know, a lot of people think they're true too. If you say the Mahayana is controversial, then you should reject your own scriptures. He's talking to the Hinayana guy again. Because they are controversial to non-Buddhists. So if the criterion is, well, controversy, well, then any time there's controversy about any scripture would invalidate the scripture that there's controversy about. See what I mean? And there are parts within the scriptures that are controversial even to your own people as well. You know, even within, in these, you know, sort of Hinayana schools, they're fighting about, like, stuff in those. So it's not controversy that can be the criterion either. So really the bottom line here is that, you know, it's really about do they function? Do they work? Do they have validity in the sense of do they bring some results to those who study and believe in them, you know, and put them into practice most importantly? Yeah. Which is another kind of like aspect of this, okay? This is a very theoretical, okay? Very sort of high philosophy and so forth. But if we don't try to put it into practice, it's just mind games. It's just mind games. It's just like, you know, there are, you know, sometimes we used to call them Dharma monsters. Dharma monsters who, you know, are intelligent and have studied a great deal and so forth. And then they just, like, argue with everyone, you know, and, like, try to prove how right they are because, you know, Shantideva in the ninth chapter of the Gita said this and that. Then you said that, and that's wrong because my... You know, that's not validating the Dharma. That's not substantiating the Dharma. You know, what validates the Dharma is whether it changes you into a better person. Not into a more argumentative person, or a person who thinks they're right and everyone else is wrong, or a person who thinks they're superior to other people like that. So the proof is in the pudding. And there are verses coming up in the next class or two where Shantideva kind of indicates that. It's like, the reason to study emptiness is to overcome unhappiness. That's the reason and especially, he says, fear. If you think that things have some real existence, self-existence, including, very much including the self, then there always will be fear. Fear from something that could come to you, could hurt you. As if there was a you there to hurt. Yeah. So there's a real function to like this doctrine, this doctrine of emptiness, this doctrine of no self, and so forth. So I think the next class is really goes into that a bit. This was one of the hardest ones because of all that mind-only stuff. So take hope. It's not all as bad as that. It's not at all as difficult as that. And like I said before, the difficulty comes because he's really introducing, you know, a school that's very technical. He's introducing a whole new school, mind-only school. And the technicalities of the mind-only school are, you know, that's a whole other, like, you know, lifetime of study. So it won't all be like this. Get easier. All right.